Up next, the flight of Apollo 8, the first manned flight to orbit the moon.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
The flight of Apollo 8. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. In an effort for NASA to beat the Soviet Union to the moon in the space race, it was decided that Apollo 8 would orbit the moon. This would involve the first manned flight of the huge Saturn V launch vehicle that would take man to the moon. The crew was Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and William Anders. They lifted off from the Kennedy Space Center on December the 21st, 1968, at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
T-minus 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. The engines are on. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit. We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have cleared the tower.
The S1C stage shook the crew. Despite all the power, the acceleration reached only 4 forces of gravity, or Gs. At engine cutoff, it dropped to 1 G. At 10 minutes 17 seconds, former crew member Michael Collins, back from his bout with a bone spur, and now at the Capcom seat rather than at the center couch of Apollo 8, opened a new era in spaceflight when he said, "All right, you're go for TLI." This was the acronym for Translunar Ejection.
Apollo 8, Houston. Go ahead, Houston. Apollo 8, you are go for TLI. Hold it.
Roger, understand. We're go for TLI.
For 5 minutes, the S-4B fired, increasing its speed from 7,600 to 10,800 meters per second. The crew now traveled at a greater speed than any human being ever had, shooting outward fast enough to escape the Earth's gravitational influence. The command and service module separated from the S-4B stage and flipped around so the crew could photograph the adapter where the lunar module would be housed on future voyages. At a distance of 223,000 kilometers from the Earth, 31 hours after leaving home and 40 before reaching the moon, the crew put on its first television show. The crew neared a new stage in manned spaceflight, traveled to a place where the pull of Earth's gravity was less than that of another body. At 3:29 in the afternoon, on Monday, December 23rd, that historic crossing was made.
Transmission is coming to you approximately halfway between the moon and the Earth. We've been 31 hours, about 20 minutes into flight. We have about less than 40 hours left to go to the moon. Showing the Earth, it's a beautiful, beautiful view with predominantly blue background and just huge covers of white clouds, particularly one very strong vortex up near the terminator. Very, very beautiful.
The spacecraft was 326,400 kilometers from the Earth and 62,600 from the Moon, and its velocity had slowed to 1,218 meters per second.
Houston, what you're seeing is the Western Hemisphere looking at the top is the North Pole. In the center, just lower to the center, is South America, all the way down to Cape Horn. I can see Baja California and the southwestern part of the United States. There's a big fog cloud bank going northeast, covers a lot of the Gulf of Mexico, going up to the eastern part of the United States. And it appears now that the east coast is cloudy. I can see clouds over parts of Mexico, the parts of Central America are clear, and we can also see the light bright spot of the subsolar point on the light side of the Earth. Okay, for colors, the waters are all a sort of a royal blue. Clouds, of course, are bright white. The reflection off the Earth is appears much greater than the Moon. The land areas are generally a brownish, sort of dark brownish to light brown in texture. Many vortices of clouds can be seen of various weather cells. And that long band of Sirius clouds that extend from the entrance to the Gulf of Mexico going straight out across the Atlantic. The Terminator, of course, cuts through the Atlantic Ocean right now, going from north to south. Southern hemisphere is almost completely clouded over, and up near the North Pole, there's quite a few clouds. Southwestern Texas and southwestern United States is clear. I'd say there's some clouds up in the northwest and over in the northeast portion.
Gradually, Apollo 8 moved farther into the moon's gravitational field and picked up its speed. Now the crew prepared for another event, LOI, or Lunar Orbit Insertion. Since the craft was on a free return trajectory, a path shaped like a figure eight that would loop the ship around the back of the moon and return it to the Earth, Borman wanted a perfect spacecraft before they considered the LOI burn. Borman, Lovell, and Anders knew that the engine had fired successfully, but a billion persons in 64 countries did not. If the spacecraft had not gone into orbit, it would come back into communications range 10 minutes earlier than planned. After what seemed like an incredibly long wait, Paul Haney, on the public information console in Mission Control, made the announcement.
Apollo Control, Houston. Jerry Carr has placed a call. We're standing by. We've heard nothing yet, but we're standing by. Apollo Control, Houston. We're looking at engine data, and it looks good. Tank pressures look good. We have not talked yet with the crew, but we're standing by. We've got it. We've got it. Apollo 8 now in lunar orbit. There's a cheer in this room. This is Apollo Control, Houston. Switching now to the voice of Jim Lovell.
Very complete. Our orbit is 160.9 by 60.5. 169.1 by 60.5.
Apollo 8, this is Houston. Roger, 169.1 by 60.5. Good to hear your voice.
The crew members told their fellow men what the moon looked like at this close range.
This is Apollo 8 coming to you live from the moon. We've had to switch the TV camera now. We showed you first a view of Earth as we've been watching it for the past 16 hours. Now we're switching so that we can show you the moon that we've been flying over at 60 miles altitude for the last 16 hours.
Astronaut Jim Lovell later recalls his experience.
When we first looked at the moon, and of course we burned into Earth or into lunar orbit, and we didn't see anything at first, and then we rolled the spacecraft around, and then all of a sudden down below us there was the lunar surface, the backside, only about 60 miles down. And, you know, I've often said we were like three school kids looking into a candy store window. Our noses were pressed against the glass. We forgot the flight plan. You know, we're just watching those ancient old craters whistle on by, because we were the first three people alive to see alive the backside of the moon. We had some pictures of it from unmanned spacecraft. And so it was, you know, probably the high point of my space career was to see the far side of the moon.
Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and myself have spent the day before Christmas up here doing experiments, taking pictures, and firing our spacecraft engine to maneuver around. What we'll do now is follow the trail that we've been following all day and take you on through to a lunar sunset. Moon is a different thing to each one of us. I think that each one carries his own impressions of what he's seen today. I know my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding type existence or expanse of nothing. It looks rather like clouds and clouds of pumice
What have you thought most about?
Well, Frank, my thoughts were very similar. The vast loneliness up here on the moon is awe-inspiring, and it makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You know, what do you think? I think the thing that impressed me the most were the lunar sunrises and sunsets. These in particular bring out the stark nature, the terrain, and the long shadows really bring out the relief that is here and hard to see in this very bright surface that we're going over right now. The horizon here is very, very stark. The sky is pitch black, and the earth, or the moon rather, excuse me, is quite light. And the contrast between the sky and the moon is a vivid dark line.
Actually, I think the best way to describe this area is a vastness of black and white. Absolutely no color.
The sky up here is also a rather forbidding, foreboding expanse of blackness with no stars visible when we're flying over the Earth, over the moon in daylight.
And one of the amazing features of the surface is the roundness of most of the craters. It seems that most of them have a round mound type appearance instead of sharp, jagged rocks.
Only the very newest features have any sharp definition to them, and eventually they get eroded down by the constant bombardment of small and meteorites.
As Apollo 8 orbited around the moon on its 10 2-hour orbits, the spacecraft location display seemed odd at first to those watching the map in mission control. In Earth orbit, spacecraft had always gone from left to right on the display panels. On the lunar charts, however, the vehicle moved from right to left. NASA had been asked by some to postpone the December lunar orbiting mission, lest some accident mark Christmas celebrations on Earth. But now, as Apollo 8 circled the moon for Christmas Eve, there was additional rejoicing. Off-duty flight director Gene Kranz recalled the mood in the Mission Control Center.
Oh, I don't think there was. I was fortunate. I was probably the most fortunate person in Mission Control because I wasn't working the mission. We had Cliff Charlesworth had picked this mission up, and I was absolutely mesmerized by what was going on. I mean, sitting next to him in Mission Control, throughout the maneuvers, and all of a sudden you find out that, my God, the crew has left the Earth's environment. Okay, it's now on a way to another planet for the first time. So, holy cow, this is something. And then the thing that really came down and grabbed me was the crew would describe the surfaces they saw. They would describe the backside. And then they started naming surface features for the people they thought got them there, the gurus and the crafts. And, you know, then they named their portions for astronauts and the pioneers who had died on the way to the moon. You sit there and say, my God, I'm glad I'm a spectator at this thing as opposed to having to do something because I got so involved in what the crew was saying. And then when they read from the book of Genesis, I cried. And that's all there was to it. I mean, this was, there's no question. There's a lot of times in my life when I've been brought to tears by just the power, the immensity, the beauty of what we were doing. And this was one of those days.
It's now approaching lunar sunrise. And for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness.
And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament. And
divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day.
God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
On the 10th lap of the moon, on Christmas morning, 3 days, 17 hours, and 17 seconds after Earth launch, the service module engine fired to increase their speed by 1,070 meters per second. Rounding the corner from the back of the moon, Lovell told Capcom Ken Mattingly, please be informed there is a Santa Claus.
Here's to the Apollo 8, over.
Hello, Apollo 8. Loud clear.
Roger. Please be informed there is a Santa Claus.
You're the best one to know.
In Mission Control, the holiday became a truly festive occasion. A Christmas tree was placed below the flight status board, which again showed the Earth map with red and green lights, the traditional colors of the season. After leaving the moon, the crew was worn out. The astronauts rested, letting Isaac Newton do most of the driving. Following their naps, the Capcom gave them the latest Earth news, with emphasis on the impact their voyage had made on the world. On the whole, Apollo 8's explorations in December of 1968 were acclaimed enthusiastically by the multitudes who looked at their world for the first time from thousands of kilometers in space and at their moon from slightly more than 100. The trip back to Earth was uneventful. During the entire trip, Command Module 103 registered only such unexpected irregularities as foggy windows, puddling water, and clattering cabin fans. Now the space-weary travelers could rest, eat, sleep, show television, and enjoy the ride home. Early Saturday morning, 14,500 kilometers above the Earth, the crew fired the pyrotechnics to separate the command module from the service module.
Standing by for go for pyro arm.
Apollo 8, Apollo 8, you have a go.
Roger. Okay, everything went fine with the check. We're all armed, ready to go here.
Houston, Apollo 8, confirm go for pyro arm.
Apollo 8, Apollo 8, Houston, your go for pyro arm.
15 minutes later, the spacecraft crossed the fringes of the atmosphere, 120 kilometers above the Earth. Borman told Ken Mattingly that they had a real fireball, but were in great shape.
Houston, Apollo, over.
Go ahead, Apollo 8. Read your focusing
code. A real fireball. It's looking good.
Outstanding.
Spacecraft speed increased to 9,700 meters per second, subjecting the crew to a load of nearly 7 Gs. The craft flew an entry curve to a point over northeast China, slanted to the southeast, and landed on target in the mid-Pacific. The craft came down in darkness on Friday, the 27th of December, 6 days, 3 hours, and 42 seconds after launch, flipping over on its nose as it landed.
We have no words or no indication yet whether on the attitude of the spacecraft, whether it's nose down, as was the case in Apollo 7, or up. But nearly everyone agrees it's only 5,000 yards away from the Yorktown. Frank Borman is making small talk with the crew of that helicopter out there. It was just relayed to us that he had, in chatting with the pilot, he'd asked him if anyone had seen the spacecraft on Main Street, and of course there were several reports, and this has become the subject of a continuing chat. In conversation with the helicopter commander, the crew commander, apparently the helicopter, asked the crew what the moon was made out of, whereupon Borman responded, it's not made out of green cheese at all, it's made out of American cheese.
Until Frank Borman punched the button that inflated the airbags to upright the spacecraft, its flashing light beacon was lost to the sight of the recovery helicopters. Mission ground rules require a daylight recovery, so Borman and his crew waited 45 minutes for the swimmers to open the hatches. A few minutes later, the helicopter deposited the crew on the deck of the USS Yorktown for the last lap of, in Borman's words, a most fantastic voyage.
You're listening to The Space Program. And now, for current and future NASA news, let's go to Dr. Tony Phillips with Science at NASA.
Deep Space One, the archaeology mission, presented by Science at NASA. 1,000 years from now, NASA's Deep Space One probe could make some archaeologist very happy. "We've got it in the tractor beam, Doctor," called the pilot. "It's a small spaceship, an old one by the looks of it." "About 1,000 years old, if I'm right," replied the archaeologist. "Will it fit in the cargo hold? Beam it aboard. I want to take a look." The air shimmered and the craft materialized, suspended in midair. It was a boxy cylinder about the size of a person, with wings stretching 10 meters from tip to tip. "Primitive solar arrays," he nodded. The walls of the craft were blackened from long exposure to space radiation. There was one big dent, as if the craft had strayed too close to an active comet, and lots of tiny pits, 1,000 years worth of micrometeoroid impacts. It was a genuine ship from the early space age. Then he noticed a puffed-out spot in the insulation, and a flap. Something was in there. He reached inside and pulled out a compact disc. Scrawled across it in marker pen were the words, "Deep Space One." "That's how I imagine it will happen," says Mark Raymond, the project manager of NASA's Deep Space One probe, who tucked the CD inside his spacecraft just before it was launched in 1998. "The CD is a time capsule," he explains. "It contains information about the spacecraft and its mission, some personal messages from our team, and more than 800 drawings made by school kids depicting what they think life might be like 1,000 years from now." In the next millennium, he says, elementary students may send probes to other stars as science fair projects. In such an advanced era, archaeologists will be very interested in how we solved our engineering problems back in the late 20th century. Problem solving is what Deep Space One was all about. Its mission, sponsored by NASA's New Millennium Program, was to test 12 cutting-edge technologies, among them an experimental ion engine, a solar array that focused sunlight for extra power, and an autopilot with artificial intelligence. "There was a good chance DS-1 wouldn't work at all. There were so many untried systems on board," recalls Raymond. It worked so well, however, that NASA approved an extended mission, which Raymond and colleagues had dreamed up even before DS-1 left Earth, a visit to a comet. In September 2001, with its technology tests completed and nothing to lose, DS-1 swooped past the furiously evaporating nucleus of Comet Borelli. "We thought the spacecraft might be pulverized," recalls Raymond, "but once again DS-1 defied the odds. It captured the best ever view of a comet's heart and emerged intact." After the comet encounter, the DS-1 team conducted a few more technology tests. That was the hyper-extended mission, says Raymond. But time was running out. In December 2001, DS-1 had been operating 3 times longer than originally planned, and it had nearly exhausted its supply of hydrazine, a thruster gas used to keep the solar arrays pointed toward the sun. Controllers had no choice but to deactivate the spacecraft. The mission was over. Or was it? "I think of it as the beginning of the archaeology mission," laughs Raymond. DS-1 is still going around the sun in a roughly circular orbit between Earth and Mars, perfect for a time capsule. Most interplanetary space probes will never be recovered. The Voyager spacecraft, for example, were flung out of the solar system by encounters with Jupiter and Saturn. Ditto for Pioneer 10 and 11. And Mars orbiters like Viking 1 and 2 will eventually disintegrate in that planet's atmosphere. Compared to those others, the orbit of Deep Space One is stable and well-behaved. Gravitational encounters with Earth and Mars, which happen every few years, and the gentle push of sunlight, will act to change the orbit over time, but not by much, says John Giorgini of the JPL Solar System Dynamics Group. "Using a simple solar radiation pressure model, I integrated the orbit to the year 3002 AD. The orbit's eccentricity, perihelion distance, and inclination will be about the same then as they are now. I can't say, however, on which side of the sun the spacecraft will be in 3002, so the archaeologist might have to hunt around a bit. Just enough, perhaps, to add to the thrill of discovery. And when it's found? I think it'll go straight to the Smithsonian, predicts Raymond. The only real question is this: the Smithsonian on Earth or the one on Mars? Editor's note. There is, of course, no official Deep Space One archaeology mission. It just happens that DS-1 is well suited for some future archaeologist to recover and study. Why 1,000 years from now? Seemed appropriate because DS-1 is sponsored by the New Millennium Program. This story was written and read by Tony Phillips and presented by Science at NASA. To find more Science at NASA stories on the Internet, please visit science.nasa.gov.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.